The relationship of government to the people when it comes to cheese sandwiches, welfare, probation, and campaign finances in America and Venezuela. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions, number 12. I'm betting that even Generation Xers like me, who could identify that song by the piano intro, are probably very few and far between. That's the Lunch Ladyland comedy song by Adam Sandler, and so you'll want to stay tuned to the end when I sing a few lines from it. Or maybe you don't, but I would recommend it. I picked that song this week not only because it's kind of fun, but because it. There's a Bob Plane has an article on RI Future today about lunch shaming. Apparently, it's a thing now in school districts where an Obama policy required them to have a policy of what to do about parents who don't pay their kids' lunch bills. Presumably, having to do with the free and reduced lunch program. You know, you pay a couple bucks for the meal. So what do you do? And what schools are coming up with around the country are ways of shaming the children. You wear a band, you get a stamp on your hand, or maybe in Rhode Island, the popular option is to serve them the bare minimum meal that still counts for the federal program. So it's a cheese sandwich and maybe some fruit. And that's what the kid gets until the parents pay the bill. No hot lunch. That's it. Here's your two slices of bread with some cheese, kid. You know, and what strikes me is it's so it brings to mind a movie like Matilda, which my children love, where the kids go to some school with this terrible, abusive headmaster who makes them do terrible things. And that's where what we've come to with government is think of the relationship of the government to the people in this case. I mean, you don't do that. I wrote on theoceanstatecurrent.com this morning that you try to imagine a private school, like not an elite one that can get away with stuff because rich people want their kids to be there to interact with other rich people's kids. Think of a middle class, working class private school or a school that caters to people who aren't this uber wealthy. Can you imagine them, deliberately shaming the children of their clients in order to get the $5 that they're owed for lunch? I mean, come on, it's not even the idea that it's a private school and they don't need the $5 versus, I mean, these public schools have budgets in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're going to be beating up kids over giving kids embarrassing food or somehow trying to shame them over $5-$10. I mean, even if you run up a tab at $2 a meal, you have to be 50 meals behind in order to get up to $100 per student. Just the idea that this is something that needs adults in decision-making positions and school committees and such sitting around thinking of how can we solve this problem of children not eating not paying for their meals, their subsidized meals. I mean, in a private enterprise, you figure out ways to get the money without embarrassing your client. You've got to find that balance. So maybe you have a mandatory fee that has to be paid at the beginning of the year, or maybe you have to give your credit card or something and they can charge you automatically, or your bank account is how a lot of private schools do things with tuition. Or maybe you just generally overcharge beyond cost by a penny or two per meal. And then very quickly you have a reserve of money you can use to bridge these gaps as you harass the parents to pay you. I mean, really it comes down to the relationship. I mean, this is not client and provider. It's not even really, a social worker and beneficiary. This is pretty, subject and ruler. This is the government saying, you know what, we need to make these people pay, and so we're going to find ways to embarrass their children. It doesn't surprise a small government person like me at all. I mean, some years ago, when people, taxpayers in Tiverton, and, you know, I refer to Tiverton mainly because I have a lot of, you know, actual, you know, on the job experience, so to speak, here. But there, as soon as taxpayers started pushing back and winning a few victories on the budget, especially some years back, it became pretty clear that this people, insiders who were dependent on the government to have big budgets were not happy about losing their leverage. And one guidance counselor actually got up in a meeting and suggested that the school administration had to find ways to essentially hurt the students to get the parents to go vote for higher budgets. This is the incentive that's built up when people really don't have choices in their options. When you have, it's a hardship for a parent to take their children out of the school and go somewhere else. You either have to move or pay for tuition on top of all your taxes, which already cover essentially a tuition. The idea that we're under this kind of a control that puts us in these situations that, you know, you watch a movie like Matilda and you think, why are the parents accepting this? I mean, that's sort of the hardest premise. I mean, it's almost harder to believe than this little girl with telekinetic powers, right? That parents are just going to let their children go into this hellhole of a school where there's this dictator of a principal or headmaster, whatever you would call her, who physically abuses children. That's just not believable. And here we are saying, sorry, kid, your mom owes us $5. So you get the cheese sandwich. Anyway, the question that it raises is who's working for whom? And what are we doing with our programs and our services? This has been on my mind in particularly because I've been reviewing a video from the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity in January, had participated with the Hassenfeld Institute at Bryant and the Family Prosperity Initiative nationally, and had a forum in January. And one of the themes that really kind of arose out of that was that Rhode Island is paying a lot for government services and not getting what it should, not getting much. One of those case in point was Grant Collins, who worked in the area of the TANF program. That's standard welfare. You know, that's getting money from the government as a welfare payment. He, under the Bush administration, he worked with TANF, and now he works with nonprofits that handle the same kind of subject matter. And He had some pretty shocking things to say about Rhode Island, and here's one of them.
Unfortunately, the information is not pretty. Either the second worst or the worst performance in all of the United States occurred in the welfare program on work participation in here in Rhode Island. The five-year average is also the worst at 11.3. What does 11.3 mean? It means 11 people out of 100 people on welfare who are required to participate in a work activity did so for 20 or 30 hours a week. If that's not disturbing enough, well, there's the average. That's not disturbing enough if you flip it and say, what percent of the population who is supposed to be doing something 20 or 30 hours a week are doing nothing, then you get this chart. From 2010 to 2014, the state of Rhode Island averaged 77 people out of 100 who were supposed to be in work or doing work activities had no hour in any activity in any week in any month for the entire 12 months.
So let me kind of explain what he's talking about here. This is, you know, TANF has since the 90s and the Newt Gingrich revolution in the House under President Bill Clinton, where the GOP came in and kind of forced his hand, forced him to the center, which turned out to be very good for the country, and for Clinton's legacy, as it happens. But anyway, at that point, the federal government started to require some kind of work activity. Now, President Obama came in and controversially, among some, removed the work requirement. You know, the excuse was the recession and states needed some latitude and all that kind of stuff. Rhode Island naturally jumped right on it. But what Grant Collins is saying in that clip is, you know, Rhode Island, very, very few of the people are working. I mean, even if you're supposed to be working from 20 to 30 hours, and work is very, very broad. You're talking any kind of activity that's working or related to work, volunteerism works, charity, work training, drug rehab, all kinds of things can apply here. And I confirmed with Mr. Collins after the fact and went up to ask him, and this is actually, what he's saying is people are not actually even getting the services. So time spent with social workers could count, for example. And we're definitely not low on resources. We are actually doing just fine. There's lots and lots of money involved. And let me play another clip, because it's a key point I want to be able to have him make again here.
Rhode Island's program, Rhode Island Works, it has the lowest performance on work participation in the United States on the past 5 years. At the same time, it has the highest percentage of individuals who should be doing something that are doing nothing. I don't mean something that doesn't count. I mean literally zero. So this law was supposed to usher in reciprocity, and it appears here that a person can get their welfare check, stay on assistance for 60 months, and about 80 out of 100 will not get any services. If I were a legal aid attorney, I would have a field day, because I would be asking for all those participants hours and months given back to them every time they didn't get service from the state.
So Rhode Island Works has the lowest performance in the United States. Now this is not an indication of the amount of money we're being reimbursed. This program is supposed to provide the cash services in addition to other things. So the money's coming in, federal tax dollars being collected from us as federal taxpayers, going to the state of Rhode Island to provide services that we're also paying for through the state tax system, and they're not being provided. The services are not being provided. People are getting their checks. They're sitting on them for 60 months up to, getting the money, the cash. But the people we're paying, the employees, are not providing services. They're not helping people find ways to stay active, not keeping on them to stay active. Somehow this money just flows right through. Now, another speaker right after Mr. Collins was David Safavian. I might be saying it wrong. He's with the American Conservative Union, and as an ex-convict himself, that's his area of specialty, criminal justice reform and such. And he gave a very similar impression in his area of expertise. In Rhode Island, he notes that we've got very low incarceration, which, as we might remember from some years ago, was a budgetary issue. So we've also got a very high probation rate. We've shifted, essentially, it seems, people to high probation. And if you recall, there was a lot of employee union issues and why we started to make that transition, I believe. But we've also got high recidivism. So we've got a high rate of people going back to, I think about half go back to prison at some point within the next 3 years. And naturally we have very high costs. Safavian put it at $58,000 per prisoner we're paying in the state of Rhode Island. And that's high, as he says, nationally.
That $58,000 number skews very high compared to the national average for cost of incarceration. So cost to incarcerate somebody at the federal level is about $41,000. The national average cost is about $40,000. So you guys are paying, about 45% more on average to incarcerate the same type of people. So we have this high recidivism rate. We've got an expensive system.
And that's really the key. I mean, really the big question, the big problem. We're paying a lot for everything around here, and we're not getting anything. Drive on our roads. We're paying for roads. We didn't need tolls to do roads. I mean, that money is baked into our taxes. We assented, in essence, we assented to high taxes for better services, and the services keep getting worse, and we keep getting told we need to pay more to get the basics that we think we ought to be getting. Now, we can argue and fight over these programs. We can argue about whether how much we should pay for people for other people's children to have lunch. We should argue. We can argue about how much money we should pay people who can't find work to not find work, and how much work they ought to be having to do, and what requirements ought to be imposed there. And we can argue about certainly about what crimes ought to land people in jail, how long they ought to be there, how long they ought to be monitored and in probation afterwards, and what requirements we're going to impose on them. We can argue all of these things, but we're not even getting the services. We've collectively, you could say, agreed that we should provide. We're not getting them. We're just supporting what I've been calling the government plantation, which is any excuse that the state government can put people on a program and charge other people, either directly or through the federal government, to provide those services that they've put people in their program for. That's the government plantation. So the less work the government employees actually have to do, hey, the better for them, right? They just need the people to be signed up through the Unified Health Infrastructure Program or whatever it might be. And then they've got you, and they can insist that people are still dependent, even though they're not getting the services that taxpayers are sold on to provide to these people. And that's a real, real major problem. And it affects, again, who's working for whom. It affects our relationship with government. It affects how government looks at us. On one hand, the government plantation image is that we are being cultivated. We're the crop, you know, and the taxpayers are the ones who have to keep picking the crop. We're paying somebody to pick it. We don't even. It's like, I guess if you could, I'm way beyond where I want to be in trying to come up with metaphors on the spot. But if you could picture the plantation, and the crop is the people who are on government services. That's supposedly the product, but we're finding out that we're paying people to pick it, and they're not. It's just we're paying essentially for all these people to be out in the field, uncultivated, so to speak. All right, and I'll stop there. I'm going to get myself in trouble if I haven't already. Now all of this, so you've got this. You've got this system where you've got the government changing its relationship with the people. All of this puts, in my mind, another light on campaign financing. I've been writing a lot about Governor Raimondo's, it's bill number H6115, which is supposedly some good government kind of initiative. And as I wrote, I don't see how anybody could claim to be good government and support this sort of a thing. Just knowing that it bans people from running for office if they owe campaign finance report money, that ought to be just the end of the story there. But it's much more than that. It increases fines. So if you miss, and I've done this multiple times, if you miss a date to get in a form because it's just so arduous. All these forms you've got to fill out, and you've got deadlines here, and the deadlines aren't just regular. They change depending what is a campaign year and this and that and the other thing. And if you miss a date, you owe $25 out of the gate. This legislation would make that $100. And my favorite is that at the end of it, if somebody's convicted or pleads guilty on a campaign finance or other kind of corruption charge, this would allow the state to take their campaign money. So Governor Raimondo has, or let's Sheldon Whitehouse, as I spoke with John DePietro the other day, you're talking between $1 million and $2 million in their campaign accounts. So if one of them were to be busted for some kind of corruption charge, the state could say, okay, thank you for that $1 million. We're going to put it in a general fund and spend it however we want. You know, maybe after we've spent, paid off some of the people you owe money to or something like that. But this is really arduous stuff. I hear from people locally all the time that they can't believe all these reports they have to file. And the emails go back and forth every time somebody gets a whiff of some deadline. Do I owe this? Do I have to do this? And then you've got the Board of Elections sending out notices to people like, oh, you may have to file. well, can't you just send the notice to people who do have to file? It's just this kind of stuff drives people away from running for office. So I wrote this in testimony I submitted for the Center for Freedom and Prosperity on another bill that does similar stuff, H5948. And my point in that was sometimes it's helpful just to succinctly say what you're doing here. And in this case, the bottom line is you're blocking people from running for public office. That has never in history been a good positive thing. There's always something. And in that regard, I was it caught my ear when I heard Jay Nordlinger in his Q&A podcast on Ricochet talking to Hannah Dreyer, who's an Associated Press reporter down in Venezuela. And this came to mind when I heard her speaking there.
The government's kind of shown that it'll do anything to leaders of the opposition, from jailing them to saying that they can't run for office for 15 years, which they did to another major leader. It's a scary time, I think, for most activists and most politicians.
Now, obviously, you could say the United States is nowhere near Venezuela, but it's all about the way in which government sees the people and in the way that we accept being seen by government. So it's, yeah, in degree, we're not at the point of Governor Raimondo saying, oh, you oppose me, I therefore ban you from running for a public office for 15 years. Yeah, we're not there. But the idea that the government can, that there's it's constitutionally allowed for the government to regulate campaigns for public office, and then to ban you if you get tripped up and owe some money. I wrote regarding the cheese sandwiches and the school lunches. I wrote that a whole lot of bad policy decisions have to be made before you get to the point of shaming children with cheese sandwiches. You've got to accept the role of the near monopoly of public schools. You've got to accept the obligation to collect money from people to finance lunches for everybody. You've got to expand that program. You've got to decide what you have to have minimum standards for the lunches. You've got to assume that there has to be some mechanism for the school to get the money ultimately. All of these decisions down the road bring you to the red flag of a child sitting down with their tray with a pathetic cheese sandwich on it. It's the same thing here. Maybe there's some rationale up earlier in the decision-making process where, all right, there's a lot of money in politics and we need to get that out. And so then you start laying down rules and, all right, so now you have to file this and, oh, well, we want to be able to catch corruption. So well, you have to file that. And now there's an ethics commission and you got to do that. And there's also campaign finance. And now you have to put in your bank account and you have to have a treasurer and all this stuff. And then you get tripped up and, well, people aren't paying their fines. And so we've got to do something about that. And okay, well, to force them to pay their fines, well, now you can't run for office. How do we get here? As step by step, we're changing the way we think of government. And so when it comes to the point of Venezuela, we accept that government can do that sort of thing. Do you see how that goes? We prepare ourselves for that, and we concede that the government does have the authority to tell you that you cannot run for public office. Now, look, I don't like the idea that Buddy Sansi, I listen to Crime Town, I don't like the idea that Buddy Sansi could be busted twice and still make comebacks. For a while, I was avoiding, I would opt not to go on his show on WPRO, because I just, the idea that he was a public figure still bothered me. But you know what? If people want to re-elect him, it's not for the government, the incumbents now, to say, no, you can't do that. If people wanted to give Gordon Fox money, not all of it corruptly, it's not up to the state government to say, oh, well, he was busted, so we get to take that money now. That's not government's role. There should be a big, not even a line, there ought to be a wall right there where, no, you're just not allowed to, just like you're not allowed to regulate speech, you're not allowed to regulate campaigning. I mean, you have to have rules that people need to follow in order to get on the ballot so that you don't have people cheating. But you're not allowed to just to regulate it to the point where people are just jumping through hoops because you've got some pretense that you're going to capture some corrupt official. So there's literally blocking people from the ballot. And then there are all these hurdles that effectively block it. People will decide not to run for office because of this. It's like taxes. It's just another thing people don't want to have to deal with, all these forms and whatever. Oh, come on, man. You know, and it's completely different. The skill set and the tolerance for putting together all these forms and jumping through hoops is completely different from the public service that people want to be providing. And this is not a healthy way to go. What we need to do, if you wanted to get the money out of politics, make politics less important. If you don't want billionaires having incentive and multinational companies having incentive to get involved in government, make government less powerful. And the way ultimately to do that is to limit in our own minds what it is we allow, we accept government to do. Government should not be handing kids cheese sandwiches. Government should not be preventing us from running for public office. Government should not be taking money to pay people to not provide services, whether in welfare or in the criminal justice system. Government should be small. And when we have that perspective, then there's no incentive for multinationals to buy people off. You want to get rid of dark money? End the ability, the concept, the notion that government is a corporate board governing every aspect of our lives and trying to make sure that we're all happy and safe and friendly and what have you. That's just not the role. But it is my role to try to provide content that's informative or entertaining or some that has some reason for you to listen to it or read it or watch it, whatever it might be. So please go to oceanstatecurrent.com. You can find my email there or leave a comment and let me know what your questions you have. Maybe I'll start doing Q&A stuff, or just let me know what might entertain you more or inform you better about these podcasts. In the meantime, keep your lunches hot and your sloppy joes off your shirt.
I woke up this morning and I put on my new plastic glove. Serve some heated Salisbury steak with a little slice of love. I got no clue what the chicken pie is made of. No student can escape the magic of Lunch Lady Land. Hoagies and grinders, hoagies and grinders, navy beans, navy beans, navy beans. Hoagies and grinders, hoagies and grinders, navy beans, navy beans, meatloaf sandwich. Sloppy Joe, sloppy, sloppy Joe. 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 Everybody gets enough food down here in Lunch Lady.